I would like to introduce George Talapoulos and Penny Poole from the Summit Foundation to talk to us about a number of things relating to the NDIS and the SDA. Specialist disability accommodation and the framework for the SDA has changed the way people with disabilities can access housing. With a focus on choice and control and an emphasis on people with only the most extreme disabilities receiving funded support for housing, there is a role for advocacy to ensure people with disabilities can access the most suitable housing for their needs. This presentation will cover the pathway to the SDA under the NDIS, some useful housing resources, and a discussion of the emerging systemic advocacy issues related to the implementation of the SDA framework. So welcome, George and Penny.
Good morning, I'm Penny Poole. I'm from the Summer Foundation. I just need the clicker. Thank you. And I'm going to do the first bit about SDA and how that works, and then George is going to talk about the systemic issues, the policy issues relating to this. So the Summer Foundation's mission is to resolve the issue of young people in nursing homes, and we believe that all people with disability are valuable members of society. We're created by Di Winkler in 2006, and the mission of the Summer Foundation is to lead, demonstrate long-term sustainable changes that stop young people being forced to live in nursing homes because there's nowhere else for them. And I think while there's any young people in nursing home, there's an existential threat to all people with disabilities. Currently there's about 6,225 young people in nursing homes across Australia. How do we do our work? So our research underpins work that provides evidence base for policy change and practice. Enabling young people with disability and their families to tell their stories is a powerful and effective tool for influencing the general public and decision makers and politicians. We prototype potential solutions. This is an iterative process involving designing, building, evaluating and learning. We capture, document and disseminate knowledge generated from our research and prototypes and encourage others to replicate the work we're doing. And over the last year, I've been writing a lot of resources on housing and the NDIS. The source of my material has been basically the legislation, the NDIS Act 2013, the SDA Rules 2016, NDIS Operational Guidelines, and working with participants to go through the process and learning that way. We're also in constant contact with advocates. So if you've got information that you'd like to share with me, please email me or come up and see me after this presentation. I'm really always keen to learn, and I'm sure there's so much knowledge in this room, and I don't get out of the office enough, I can tell you. I'm too busy writing. So that's what we've agreed to talk about today. So I just want to explain something about specialist disability and about housing in the NDIS generally. So at full rollout, the scheme's meant to have 460,000 people in it. They're imagining that about 160,000 of those participants will be under 18 and living with their families. And so this shows where the other 300,000 are expected to live. So 88,000 living by private means, 57,000 in existing affordable housing, 28,000 will have NDIS in their plans, and there's unmet need for 127,000. So people with disabilities are not escaping the affordable housing crisis in Australia. And it's going to be really critical. There's going to be a lot of people testing their eligibility for SDA. So my presentation is really going to take you through the process of what that involves, testing your eligibility for SDA. Okay, before you can test your eligibility for SDA, you actually have to search for a mainstream housing option. There's just no way around this, and you have to provide the agency with evidence that you've done this. So can I just have a show of hands? How many people here are pretty confident about housing generally? Done advocacy around housing? Okay, traditionally, disability workers haven't really thought a lot about housing because the only housing options were you lived at home with your family, you lived on your own, or if you really needed it and you had a crisis and you met the definition of disability under the Victorian Disability Act, you might find yourself in shared supported accommodation. The NDIS is a really new ball game. That link between a crisis has been and getting a place in shared supported accom has been broken. The NDIA does not own any housing, it doesn't operate any housing, and it employs no direct support staff. So if there's a crisis in the life of someone that you work with, there's not an obvious agency or a government department who feels that it's their responsibility to find a place for that person with disability or for yourself. So it's really important that you act early and think about housing before there's a crisis and know where you stand and how the scheme can help you and how it's going to work. So to do this, the first resource that I suggest people work through is My Housing Preferences. It's really long. You can use it soft copy or hard copy. I think soft copy would be better. And it just takes you through, gets people to think about their housing history, their support history, what works for them, where they'd like to live, why they'd like to live there. You know, do you want to live in a city, middle ring, rural, regional, outer suburbs? You know, what's important to you? What do you need to be close to? How does this make your support work better? Do you need to be near family or employment or various other opportunities? I really recommend this document. The utility of it's been proven over and over again as more people have put in SDA applications. And one of the really good things that it provides the opportunity to do is for people to get to know the person they're working with or the person to do it themselves and really put their own voice in there, because the voice of the person with disability is going to be really critical in conversations with the NDIA. So I've read lots of applications for the DSR and I've really never seen much content that is the voice of the person with disability. The NDIS is not really interested in what support coordinators think should happen. The NDIS is looking for what the participants' needs and preferences are. And so this is a really good document to capture that. It also probably, if you're not familiar with housing, it probably is going to throw up some new ideas and new living arrangements that people with disability and their families might want to consider. The other thing that we've done is we've produced sample NDIS plans because they sort of become NDIS participants, they don't know what a plan looks like, they don't know how they work, and that makes pre-planning really hard and it makes setting appropriate goals really hard. So the NDIS plans show the sorts of supports you can get and the different categories that you can get them under, whether it's a core support, a capacity building support, or a capital item. And it gives some hints and tips, like get plan management if you can't self-manage. And it demonstrates how funding is linked to goals and has some good goals in there. So if you're looking for funding to search for housing, you need a housing-related goal. The NDIS will only fund things that directly relate to your goals, and I'd really recommend that you make housing either goal one or goal two. There used to be a thing called the Exploring Housing Options Package. They don't sort of fund packages in the NDIS, they fund individually related to your need. So your planner and the delegate will make a call about the sorts of the amount of support coordination you might need to look for housing. But this is a good amount of support coordination, and it includes 55 hours for someone to write a housing plan. And I'm going to talk about what a housing plan might look like a bit further on. You might also get funding for allied health assessments, and they're really critical. So when the NDIS is determining what to fund in relation to housing, it's my guess that they are going to think about what is the opinion of allied health assessors, what does the participant want, and then perhaps what their informal support network want and what the support coordinator has to say. So working with really good allied health professionals is really important, and it's a huge shift for them. They can no longer talk in the language that they've talked. They need to understand the logic and language of the NDIS. And do not spend people's money on allied health assessments unless they're really committed to working in this space.
Okay, this is a really complicated journey, and I've tried to break it down, and we've got a graphic, an infographic on the website that you can download. I'm currently altering this in relation to sort of more experience that we've gathered, but essentially the grey part of the journey is the search for a mainstream housing option, and the blue part of that roadmap is a search for SDA. And as I said before, you really have to demonstrate that you've exhausted any opportunity to live in a mainstream housing with supports before you can contemplate testing your eligibility for SDA. So what are some of the mainstream housing options? I'm just going to click these up. I won't read them out, but these slides are going to be turned into a PDF and they'll be sent to you or put up on the Diary website so you can come back to them. But here are some of the ones that we know about. And once again, if you're working with people who've come up with some pretty innovative housing solutions for themselves, really keen to hear about them and promote them, because there just hasn't been much depth of knowledge in the disability field before about different ways to live, given that you can now get support individually through the NDIS. And that's why we've included links to videos and stuff that really deepen your knowledge about how it works and how other people have combined a housing arrangement with appropriate supports. Okay, we've also produced a guide, Living More Independently. So that's the sort of thing, if people and perhaps their families are concerned about what living more independently might look like, that's a guide that takes people through that. And we've got a mainstream housing guide that's about to go on with the website as well. It's currently in design. So there's lots of resources there to do this first part of the journey, to test the availability and whether or not you can live in a mainstream housing option. Bearing in mind that the NDIS will provide the following supports to assist you to live in mainstream housing: capacity building supports, assistance with daily living, developing or sustaining your informal support network, home modifications, and assistive tech. So you have to think about all the possible housing options. Could I combine them with any or all of these and make a mainstream housing option work for me? If you find a mainstream housing option and it's going to work for you, move. Don't hang out for SDA. If you can make it work, do make it work. And there's some real advantages, I guess, in that you are an ordinary citizen in lots more ways, and you know your housing is much more determined by your needs and preferences. When you get into the SDA, you're kind of in the system, and there's, you know, you lose a bit of control over what's going on. So, you know, take amazing mainstream housing option if you can. If you can't access mainstream housing because of the level of your disability. And I want to be really clear here that there is an affordable housing crisis, and the fact that you can't afford a mainstream housing option is not a reason to try and access SDA. The NDIS is really clear that it is not a part of government that is here to make up for the fact that the disability support pension is completely inadequate. That's not their, it's not in their remit. Okay, so let's just talk quickly about Specialist Disability Accom. Who are we talking about? We're talking about that 28,000. 6% of all scheme participants. It's not many people. I can see a head shaking. Who are these people? Well, the Productivity Commission thought, we've probably got 16,000 currently in shared support at Accom. We've got 6,200 people in residential aged care. And then they looked at all the states and territories' wait lists, although they're never called wait lists, for shared support at Accom. And they came up with 28,000. I believe that's not a finite number. Like, I believe, you know, if you meet the requirements, they're not going to stop at 28,000. But I think it's worth bearing in mind it's for 6% of all schemes participants. So this is an incredibly valuable resource, and they've published separate rules which go through what the resource is, how it's managed, and who's eligible, and they're the SDA rules 2016. So if you're going to enter this space, you need to read these rules, no question. They're quite easy to read. In terms of the criteria that they've set out, there's basically two pathways that participants would test their eligibility for SDA, and I would recommend that they have a discussion with their support coordinator and an allied health professional to decide which of these pathways is most relevant to them. And in broad terms, we're looking at, do I have an extreme functional impairment? And that means that I need assistance in mobility, self-care, or self-management, and I have a very high need for person-to-person supports. Okay? Alternatively, you might have very high support needs, and that group is people who have previously lived in shared support at a com. They have very high person-to-person support needs. Informal carers are not available or unsustainable. So we're thinking there about probably aging parent carers, a risk to themselves or others. So that's probably the robust design category, people with behaviours of concern. So there's two people stream off and test their eligibility in one or other of those streams. And what is the SDA that they would then be thinking about? So there's a number of design categories and building types, but broadly speaking, people who are currently in shared support at a com or a group home, that all that housing stock has come into the scheme as basic. And what we've found is you can move around shared support at a com, existing shared support at a com fairly easily under the NDIS, and even, but you can't easily move from an existing group home into a new build without testing your eligibility through this process and against the criteria on the previous slide. Yep. So perhaps while we're waiting, you could read the slide, because then I won't read the slide later.
I was just wondering if you're already in accommodation and at that level, basic level, will they fund capacity building to get to another level?
So that's the previous slide. That's the funding of support coordination to prepare a housing plan and allied health assessments. Yeah, you definitely want to ask for that. So you need something to say, you know, I'm currently at risk in my shared support at a com and I need to explore suitable housing options, other suitable housing options.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So a housing plan, very complicated piece of work. And what we've done is develop a tool. And this tool, once again, people who want to use it should just download it. And it takes you through the legislation, the rules, the SDA rules 2006, and it provides suggestions of the type of evidence that you need and where to put it. And so what we're sort of trying to do is take you so that you provide the NDIS decision maker, and they're in a team called the Technical Advisory Team, with evidence against every single relevant section of the rule. And I think this is really important because as advocates you'll understand that if you work through this with a participant and they don't get SDA in their plan and the decision comes back, you don't have any evidence against 3.4C, and you go for a review, well, the review will be at law. They won't bring common sense to bear. They'll say, well, you didn't provide the evidence, so the original decision stands. And who are the people in the technical advisory team? They're people who have been employed to make decisions. So they could have come from anywhere. Other government agencies that make decisions are, Centrelink make decisions. So they have a piece of legislation, and then they gather evidence, and they decide whether there's, if the evidence provided allows them to make a decision to provide a support or not. And it's just administrative law. They are not necessarily interested in the backstory. They aren't reading all the material that's been on your DHHS file. All they have in front of them is the housing plan, the document that you provide to them. So that document needs to be absolutely completed to the best of your ability or the best of the support coordinator's ability. So if someone comes to you and says, I went for SDA and I didn't get it, I think you need to have a look at what they've submitted to the NDIS and compare it to the rule, and either suggest that you work together to rewrite a housing plan that does address all the criteria of the rule before you just turn around and do a review, because it is going to be a review at law on the basis of the information provided. And the reason I think that this bar is so high is because this is a really high value support. It's potentially for the life of the participant. And, you know, the decisions made need to be consistent, fair and transparent. So, you know, you just have to present the evidence. They have to have the evidence on file, and that's how it goes. Okay, so as I said, a vital part of that evidence is going to be that allied health assessments, and we've produced a guide to help people think about who to work with, and we've actually even included a sample service agreement where you say to the allied health assessor, okay, you're going to provide an assessment that covers this part of the rule and that part of the rule and that part of the rule. And so you know which bits of the rule that you still have to go and find someone else to cover off. So, you know, I'm really suggesting that you get really high quality allied health assessors who really have been in the business for a long time and can really state their credentials and win over a decision maker, so that the decision maker doesn't think that they might know better than the allied health assessments that they have before them. We've also produced a general overview to the disability accommodation payments, so that's just a good starting point to work out how they work. And should all go well, someone might get SDA in their plan. It would appear as a capital item, and this gives you a sense of how high the payments can go annually. So that will give you a sense of why they are being so tightly policed. So the payments actually are with the participant in their plan. When a participant moves into SDA, that's an SDA house that's been registered, then the provider of the SDA house starts to get those payments through to them. So they'll never hit the participant's bank account, but they travel with the participant and they should be able to move around with the participant. The NDIA are entitled to offer people in-kind housing first, and that is existing housing stock that's entered the scheme, generally shared support at a com. They've got 10 days to find that house, or you can go to the market, bearing in mind that we have various guarantees that no one has to take an in-kind option. So you might... That's a lot of the work that you as advocates might do, is with people who have been offered in kind and are not sure whether they have to take it or not. No, they don't. You'll all be familiar with the appeals process. So you do an internal review, administrative appeals tribunal, federal court and high court. So it's worth keeping an eye on the AAT website. They've got a special part of that, which is just NDIS decisions, and it gives you a really good flavour about how the legal system view the NDIS Act and the SDA rules, although I don't think there's any SDA decisions up there yet, and we're really looking for some. So, yeah, if you're working with someone on an SDA decision, don't hesitate to contact us and have a chat about that, because we're really keen to develop some case law around SDA decision making. So there's an overview of the resources that are on our website. If you just Google NDIS or Summer Foundation NDIS housing, you'll get a page that has them all on one page. And we've also developed a website to help participants find SDA. So it's called the Housing Hub. And that's just a photo of some of the new build SDA that's coming on stream. And that's the title page of the Housing Hub, and it just lists vacancies. And the states are generally coming on board and starting to list their housing on that website. So it's a good place. If you are working with people who are looking for housing, I'd do it every Monday morning. Check it out. There's also GoNest, which is a competitor website, because this is a market-based system. Something interesting about this site is that people who are doing new build SDA are often listing that and looking for tenants so that there's people ready to move in by the time the place is completed. So don't feel despondent that there is no housing. There is SDA being developed, and we think there's about 900, nearly 1,000 bedrooms in the pipeline at the moment of new build SDA. I think I'm going to hand over to my colleague, George Teleporis, to talk about emerging policy issues. Hey, George. Yeah.
Hi, I'm actually a parent of a young adult, and I'm just starting to look at this for my young man, so I'm probably asking a very basic question because I don't understand it. There's SDA and there's SIL, so what's the difference? When you talk about SDA, are you talking about bricks and mortar, or you're talking about the support to live somewhere? Is there a difference?
There is a difference.
Okay, can you
SDA
explain?
Is very clearly bricks and mortar. And SIL is supported independent living, and that's the support that goes in to live independently.
Okay, so if my young man's lucky enough that we can buy him an apartment, does that, I can then apply for SILs to have somebody look after him in that apartment? Because he's a complex young man. So this is, what's the difference? Is this you, George?
Hello, everyone hear me? That's a big question. I think that it's really important that we go back to what Penny said earlier, and that was that only 6% of people will get this support. And the feedback? And the reason that is because it's only reserved for people who are very high and complex needs, and where they need a particular build, a particular housing option, whether that be because they need equipment, and if that equipment means that they need a larger bathroom or a hoist, or the other reason is because it may be more economical for that person to live with other people. So we know that we've come from a time when group homes have dominated how people are housed, and there is still partly a emphasis on putting people together if it's going to save the NDIS money.
But that goes against choice and control, George. And, you know, group homes is not what I want for my young man. That's absolutely 100%.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it's supposed to be about choice and control. So, again, I go back to my question. Am I going to have a fight on my hands if I want him to live independently but I need someone to support him?
Yeah, so this is where we go into the policy issues, because that is clearly something that is a principle of the NDIS. So we have the principle of choice and control. We also have the principle of cost effective. Yeah. So there will be a consideration of choice and control and cost effectiveness. And this is where advocates have a very important role. Is there anyone here who has had to advocate for a person to live on their own? Yes? Can you tell us about your experience? Wait for the mic.
No, it's been a very difficult, long process for this young man and his family. I'm not working with them at the moment because we're trying a different avenue. A house was bought in trust for this young man, and supports were put in place, but the funding is not matching supports by any means, and it's just been an ongoing battle. It's at appeals at the moment, yeah. So I don't know whether a re-ex managing it at the moment, yeah.
That's what I'm really interested in.
We really don't like what's out there, you know, supported accommodation. I'm really, seriously, yeah. Don't even go there. So I'm just wondering what battle I'm going to have. It's not yet, but I'm just trying to think of the best way to go about doing this. You know, I'm not planning in the next year. It's maybe, you know, 6 or 7 years' time, but is the NDIS going to progress?
Well, you know, I think someone at the back was going to add something.
Sorry. We do have another case, actually, where a gentleman, before the SDA came out, it was about a month before they did his plan without telling him about the SDA. So he's now battling to get the SDA included in his private house. That's another one that you have to think about, because if you take a private, you can get SDA for it.
Yes.
Yep.
Hold on, we need the mic.
Sorry, I thought I had a loud voice.
No.
I'm really just not interested probably in the bricks and mortar, because I think we might be lucky enough to be able to fund that ourselves. It's more... It's the maintenance of him being able to live... Is it...
No.
But
no,
is,
okay.
No, I don't think it is SDA, isn't it? Isn't that the
sills? Allow me to then...
Sorry.
Clarify some of the policy features, and maybe this will help. So with SDA, it's very much around what the individual wants to choose around a particular level of funding for a built form. So the framework says that the funding will be attached to the individual, and that individual will be able to take that funding to purchase a particular registered SDA property that they can then live in. But at the same time, if they don't want to stay living there, they can take that funding and move it somewhere else. And the vision, so the view of the future for the market, is that there will be a range of options for people. And those options will include apartment style housing, as well as possibly the traditional group home arrangements. But the whole idea is that over time, based on people making choices, that slowly the market will develop to reflect what people with disabilities want. Next slide. Yeah.
Sorry, everyone. I think maybe if we can hold the questions until the end of George's session, and then we'll make sure we have enough time for questions before we break for lunch. And can you please make sure that we ask questions through the microphone, because the people on the live streaming can't hear you. Thank you.
I actually don't mind questions, that's fine. The other thing that that's important to notice is that even though the policy itself talks about choice and control, in the early days of implementation, we're seeing lots of problems. And one of the problems is that we're seeing the favouring of shared housing or group homes over people who want to live on their own. The other thing that we're seeing is that decisions are being made which result in the person having to live in a particular type of housing. And you know, our view is, well, the person should be able to move according to what suits them, and they might want to try out one form of housing and not be necessarily dictated by the NDIA that is what they have to have. And the other policy issue that's coming up is around families that want to live together. And we know that over half of people living in residential aged care have a partner who, you know, if they could find housing, that they could live with their partner and with their children or their, you know, person that they want to live with. SDA does not currently enable people to live with their families because of the way that pricing is set up. So if I live in SDA and then I have a family member live with me, the amount of SDA that I'm entitled to will go down. In an open market, how does that work? It doesn't work. It means that you can't get the type of housing that you need. Next one. The other thing that we're seeing is that decisions are incredibly slow. 6 months is quite common. We're hearing people have to wait even longer. There's not a lot of transparency in how decisions are made around SDA. And the other problem that we're seeing is that the language in the pricing is making it very hard for people to be able to get the kind of housing that enables innovation and for them to have the housing that they might want. So there are lots of problems that we're currently seeing. But as we all know, the NDIS is relatively new. Hopefully there will be some improvements over time. Has anyone been involved in the current review of the framework that's currently happening? So there's currently a review of the SDA framework. Yeah, someone at the back? Are you happy to tell us a little bit, Margaret, about what you are hoping to see in the review?
Yes. Hi, I'm Margaret Bulos from Carers Victoria. So we have looked at the framework in the context of the review, and we've just been suggesting and recommending that it emphasise choice and control for participants, families and carers over and above what looks like an emphasis and a preference for the group home model. I think that comes out really strongly because I think the framework is more of a kind of agreement between how the governments were trying to deal with their SDA stock rather than being quite a forward-thinking document. So.
Yeah, and what I often go back to is what you said earlier, is that the promise of the NDIS was about choice and control. It's about people making their own decisions about where they live and who they live with. And we also know that there's Article 19 of the UN Charter for Persons with Disabilities that says that people with disabilities should have full choice around who they live with. And we really want the NDIS to fulfil the charter. We want people to have the same choices as other people might have in the community. So what we need to do, I think, is make sure that we document people's experiences. If you have an experience with someone that you're advocating for, where they've been forced to live in a situation that they don't want, document it, we would like to hear about it, send it to us, but also share it amongst yourselves. And if we can put together some really strong evidence that people are not being supported in accordance with their own choices, we will have a lot more power to influence policy. And I think that's really important. Are there any questions? Yep.
Hi, me again. Just go back to, and I know that it actually already has happened when you have a crisis and parents relinquishing their children, and I believe it actually did happen earlier this year in the Geelong region. What is, I know nobody wants to take responsibilities. It always used to be the responsibility of the states and they want to get out of it, and the NDIA just think they're a banker and they don't want to do anything either. What's happening? Does anyone know what's happening in this space? Because it won't be, I believe it's happened once at the NDIA, and it won't be the last time. So does anyone know what's happening in that space?
Are you talking about provider of last resort?
Provider of last resort. When you actually have a crisis and you want to relinquish someone because you know you can't cope anymore, and we know that it happens, George, unfortunately. So yeah. What's actually been put in place? Does anyone know?
Look, I think that the current situation is that there is no provider of last resort officially. However, we know that young people in residential aged care end up in nursing homes because there's no one else to provide the sort of support that they need. We also know that people end up in hospitals longer than they necessarily should. People even end up in prison. There's all sorts of de facto providers of last resort. It's not good enough. We know that that is not where people should be. I think that is a very key advocacy need, and I think that it's important that we put that on the radar, because the NDIA doesn't see itself necessarily as a provider. Well, it doesn't at all. Yeah, there's a question at the back.
Hi, my name's Bronwyn. I'm advocate at Armida, and we currently have a situation, a person with a disability is in a supported residential service. So very similar setup, I suppose, with the restriction for how that person can use their NDIS plan. The SRS is saying that they must use the SRS support staff for their NDIS package, otherwise that person is going to be evicted. So we haven't really touched on SRSs in this conversation. I was wondering if anybody had any comments about that.
Maybe.
Not a lot to say. I'm not really aware that SRSs have support staff, frankly. I know that, probably most people under 65 in an SRS would be NDIS eligible. Whether that's going to translate, and there was some savvy workers who were working in that space and thinking about the transition to the NDIS. I think that is a hidden pool of a provider of last resort that hasn't really been... it's not a space that I've entered into thinking very much about how they come across. But I think I'd be really challenging the idea that they have support staff. I know, for example, that in residential aged care, you can't get funding for core supports for person-to-person care because under the Residential Aged Care Act, the aged care provider is meant to meet your personal care needs, right? Whether there's something in the SRS legislation that says similar, I don't know. But if that would be where I'd be going to see if there's any legislative requirement that they do meet someone's support needs, and if not, well, of course they need the core supports that they need.
And I think that one of the things that we need to be conscious of in advocacy is that we're very in tune with who is registering as an SDA provider. One of the real risks is that the market will, because it is an open market, right? So there's a risk that people who are vulnerable and who are not necessarily able to advocate for themselves will have their SRS provider say, oh, let's set ourselves up as SDA. The funding stream is a lot higher. And in some way, there is a risk that that this NDIS participant who might be eligible for housing that is better than they are now, although might not, I don't know, could miss out. So it's important that advocates are very attuned to who is providing and that the person with disability is not a captive, captive to their provider. They should be able to move around and choose a different housing arrangement if that's what they want.
Yes, sorry, Bronwyn from Armada again. Talking about choice and control, Armada have contacted the transition team at DHHS, the NDIS transition team, about this particular matter with the SRS, and they're very interested in it. What they're saying is that there isn't new law. There is the SRS regulations that were standing prior, and with the NDIS there hasn't been new guidelines set out yet. But most definitely the SRS is not able to dictate to the person how they use their NDIS package, and they certainly can't evict that person. So there's probably other cases like this going on with the rollout where the regulations aren't clear yet.
Yeah. Do we have time for another question? Yes? Yep. The hand up.
Thank you. Just really quickly, is it possible to talk about the evidence you need to provide to demonstrate you have exhausted your mainstream housing options?
Yeah, Penny is the expert on this.
Okay, so my housing preferences is basically where you would collate that information. So you'd be wanting to show that you've applied for public housing, you've provided social housing, community housing, private rental. You've thought about, can I live with a partner or family or, and you'd actually have to be demonstrating, getting letters back from real estate agents saying, oh, we haven't got any wheelchair accessible housing, or the waiting list for this is 17 years long, or you've got over $5,000 in assets, so you're not eligible for public housing. Like, you actually need to keep that evidence. But what I'm going to do in the next quarter is basically a housing plan tool for mainstream housing. So if you worked through that, that would then be at the front of your SDA application, and it would demonstrate that you've worked through all those options and that none of them would work, even with person-to-person supports, capacity building supports, assisted technology or home mods. So the other funny thing is that you can get right to the end of the SDA rules and they can go, yeah, you meet the criteria, but we're actually going to fund you for some more capacity building supports. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a snake in there, and you really need to cover off your bases and provide the decision maker with evidence that you've absolutely exhausted all other opportunities.
And can I maybe provide just a little bit of, some tips? That I think are really important, and be very, very clear in your SDA goals, your NDIS goals, about what you want. Penny said this earlier, but I can't stress this enough. The legislation says that you cannot be funded for something that is not in your goals, and for the mum at the front, state very clearly that you did not want to live in a group home. I did that in my plan, and I get funded to live in my own home 24/7. So be really clear about what you need and also what you don't want. So put that down. Put it all in writing. Don't just say it in a conversation to the planner. I think that people think that, you know, I said it to the planner and, well, no, it's not going to be enough when you're at the AAT and you relay a conversation that you had. Put everything about the person with disabilities needs, what they want, what their goals are, what they don't want. Support that with evidence from whoever you can get that evidence from, whether that is a psychologist, a behaviour support person, OT, whatever that is, and always assume that your plan might end up at AAT, at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, so that you have the paperwork and everything that you need to support your appeal. And we need more people to appeal so that we can develop case law that will inform the NDIS in the future. So they're my concluding comments. Do we have any time for any more questions? Melissa? Yeah, there's a comment at the front.
I really just wanted to say to people that you can change your goals at any time. So if you haven't got them in there, you can actually request to change goals.
Yes, but what we're hearing is any review of a plan can take 6 months or more.
It doesn't have to be a review. You can actually just ask to have your goals changed.
Yeah, but if you want funding tied to your goals, you're going to need to do that at a time when your plan is either being developed or being reviewed. So really important that you're...
It's quite interesting. I don't know if everyone saw the new ruling that's come out in the Northern Territory about plans through the AAT, so it might be worth reading up on that because there's some new rulings about plans.
Yeah. Is there a way of getting that information out to everyone that might be listening or
sure, yeah. Yeah.
Having that for
them. It'll be on the AAT site, but it's a new ruling about what the judge ruled in the federal court about plans and how they should be looked at.
Yeah.
Not as new plans, but as continuing plans. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Really important that we share information. And also, just to give you the heads up that Summer Foundation has a new podcast series 2, called Reasonable and Necessary, where you can hear all about the latest info about the NDIS. Series 1 has information about SDA. Series 2, we're talking a bit about the Quality and Safeguards Commission, and we have an interview with the new commissioner on there, so please check that out. And as I said, Penny and myself always love to receive information about what's happening to people on the ground. So email us your case studies, anything that comes to you around people who might not be getting the right kind of support. And we're also very interested in issues around housing and SDA. So I think that's all from us. Is that right? Penny, any last comments?
Just don't be intimidated. This is a new scheme. It's shambolic, but over time it'll come together. And I think we all have a really important role in making sure it comes together to reach its potential and to fulfil the principles of the Act, which is, I think, a really good Act.
Thank you.